gentlemen, on this Washington's birthday, I think back to my high school days. It was my lot during one semester to have a study hall in a room where a Greek class was being conducted, and the class was reading Xenophon's Anabasis. And even though I hadn't advanced to the point where I was studying Greek, one word was indelibly impressed on my memory, and I would remember it if I had never had any courses in Greek, and that was the word strategos, because it occurred so frequently, and I suppose the teacher had difficulty in pounding any Greek vocables into the heads of some of the members of the class. From the word strategos, we get the word strategy and the strategic, and we recognize that it's not only in the political sphere that we have generals and generalship, but also in the work of the church. We recognize, of course, that we don't take every meaning, or we don't take our use of the word from the exact meaning, the root of the any given word, and so we don't take that meaning, which then is related to the word stratagem, intrigue, and related concepts into the work of the church. But we do think of the strategy as the overall planning. And we recognize that also the soldier or the non-commissioned officer needs to know something about strategy. That was a complaint frequently heard in the days of past wars, that the individual didn't really know what he was fighting for, and also minor officers, sub-commanders, sometimes failed to do what they were supposed to because they didn't know the overall strategy. I think that's true, and very true, in the work of the church. So this morning we have with us a strategos, an alumnus of our school who finished here in the year 1930, and who, after service in a parish in the Northwest and also a time as a district executive, now is here in our Lutheran building as the executive secretary of the Board for Home Missions of our church. I'm glad to present to you Reverend Dr. William Hilmer, who will talk to us about one phase of the strategy of our church.
Thank you, Dr. Fairbringer, friends and brethren. We laughed about 5 years ago when one day we received an anonymous letter in the Lutheran building enclosing a dollar bill as the first contribution to the establishment of a mission in outer space. We're not laughing anymore because the way things are going, we might have to spend that dollar one of these days. Before I go into the paper, perhaps I ought to explain the situation for which this particular paper, which I wanted to give you this morning, was presented and prepared. Every two or three years, we hold a general home mission conference. And so for January this year, we had planned a home mission conference. However, we had decided that we would like to conduct this conference in a different manner. In former conferences, we spent a lot of time on how. How do you start new missions? How do you support them? And the various techniques and procedures involved in home missions. We thought the time had come for our home mission leaders to rethink our total home mission objective. What are we really trying to do in America? What is really our objective? And so we had as a theme for this conference, our church's mission to America. And we asked the brethren, and we had about 160 men present, mostly from district mission boards, but also the other mission boards working in North America were there. We asked them to confine their discussions to what and why, but to try and stay away from the how at this conference. And that was an interesting experience. Many of the brethren rebelled at first at that, at the thought. They said, why don't we get into the how? We all know what we're here for. But we said we thought it might be wholesome to just to think about what and why again. And some of the brethren had a pretty rough time staying with the what and the why. They wanted to get over into the how all the time. But at the end of the conference, I think they agreed that this had been very worthwhile. We had four background papers at this conference: the peopling of America, the Churching of America, which is the paper I delivered the conference, which I'm going to give you this morning. Then the mission, what is really the mission of the church? Dr. George Beto of the Springfield Seminary gave that paper. And then what is our philosophy of home missions? Our chairman, Pastor Tom Spitz, gave that presentation. Then we went into workshop sessions. Some of your faculty members were there to help us, Professor Schuler and Werfel, and spent about 3 days workshopping various aspects of our mission to America, trying to keep the brethren to talk what and why. All of the speakers were also told that they had absolute freedom to say what they wanted to say. They did not necessarily have to say what was officially accepted by the church, and they would not be quoted. So it was, a real worthwhile conference. And some of the things that were said, I'm sure they wouldn't want to be quoted. But nobody was speaking officially. And some of the things I'm going to say in this paper this morning, which I presented at that conference, I'm sure do not meet the full official approval of the church. But that's what we were there for. We wanted to rethink our whole mission program. And so my topic is the churching of America. Now, when I first began thinking about this particular topic, somehow or another, they kept coming back to my mind what I believe it was Warren Sweet said of the great impact which the Methodist Church made during the frontier days, when he wrote, "Hardly had the mud in the mud hut of the early settler dried, what the Methodist circuit rider was at the door inviting the settler to a religious service." Now, somehow this description of one denomination's efforts at the churching of America has always appealed to me, probably because it represents a strong concern for people. And so in this paper, I shall not be very much concerned about buildings and organizations, but I shall rather endeavor to show what has happened in America in the way of relating people to the church. Where do we stand today in the churching of America? What are some of the things against which we ought to be cautioned in the churching of America? What is our particular responsibility as the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the churching of America? I will say very little about the basic principles which should guide us in the churching of America, because Dr. Beto did that in another paper. So this paper, standing by itself, is very incomplete from that standpoint about the real purpose. What are we really trying to, what is our goal? I will simply say that Dr. Beto in his paper cautioned against the institutionalized approach in home missions. And perhaps we could summarize this approach this way, that he held before us as our goal a growing number of people in America who worship and serve the true God and serve each other. That we're not building the church, but we are endeavoring to relate people to the true God. Now, naturally, in a paper like this, you will have to bring in a few statistics. And while I personally don't care a great deal about spending a lot of time on statistics, yet for completeness sake, I guess you have to do it. I might say that in this section and throughout the paper, I draw primarily on two sources: the 1961 Yearbook of American Churches, prepared by the National Council of Churches, and the Annals, the November issue, 1960 issue of the Annals, published by the American Academy of Political and Social Science. The November issue was devoted entirely to religion in American society, a very worthwhile publication. As far as the United States is concerned, let me just give you two statistics. I think maybe you can latch on to them and remember them and use them. And those two statistics are 23 and 63. 100 years ago, 23 out of every 100 people in America were related to some church. Today, 100 years later, it's 63 out of every 100 people related to some religious organization. So in a 100-year period, the percentage jumped from 23 to 63. For Canada, the figures are somewhat comparable, although they do not arrive at the statistics in the same way. Canada, for example, the latest statistics we had was the Roman Catholic Church there represents 43%, the United Church of Canada 20%, and if you add these all up, you almost come out at 100% for Canada. But my Canadian brethren tell me that most, a great majority of the people there are related to the church in name only. But I would like to say something about the limitation of church statistics. We use church statistics so frequently and so often, and I think we ought to be aware of the limitations. There are great limitations. Extreme care must be used in interpreting church statistics. Between 1890 and 1958, there were 30 different compilations of church membership. Five of these were made by the U.S. Census Bureau according to standardized methods. The others were made by private groups and bodies, but not always according to any standardized method. Again, the various church bodies use various standards for reporting membership. The Eastern Orthodox churches include all persons in the nationality or ethnic groups being served. The Jewish congregations regard as constituents all Jews in communities having congregations. The Roman Catholics count all baptized persons, including infants. Most Protestant bodies count only the persons who have attained full membership. And previous estimates have indicated that all but a small percentage of these are over 13 years of age. The Lutheran bodies and the Protestant Episcopal Church report all baptized persons rather than only those that have been confirmed and have attained full membership. Another interesting thing, many of the large church bodies report their membership figures in round numbers, and as a rule, those are estimates and are usually higher than they should be. Like one denomination reported its membership for a certain county in Texas, and it turned out that the membership was larger than the population of the county. Nevertheless, in spite of all these limitations, it would appear that a growing number of people in America are being affiliated with the church. Now, which are the churches that are experiencing the greatest growth? In the publication referred to above, the Annals, we're told that Richard C. Wolfe, associate professor of church history at Oberlin, studied the changes in American religious life for a period of 7 years and made this observation: the more conservative groups have had greater success in enlisting members than have the more liberal groups, unquote. This is a significant statement and one which provides much food for thought. Professor Wolfe then goes on and cites some examples. In the 50-year period, the first 50 years of this century, the Churches of Christ, the Latter-day Saints, the Lutherans, the Baptists, and the Roman Catholics reported gains much above those of the Presbyterians, Methodists, Disciples of Christ, and the Congregationalists. Continuing our quote from Professor Wolfe, the Southern Baptists reported gain far in excess of the American Baptist, formerly the Northern Baptist. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, says Dr. Wolfe, reports a gain above that of the United Lutheran Church. I don't know which group he would hold to be the more conservative. But the Presbyterian Church in the United States, often called the Southern Church, reports a gain in excess of that of the United Presbyterian Church. Adventist Brethren and Mennonites, he says, give figures showing gains far above those of the Friends, Universalists, and Unitarians. Roman Catholic gains are below all of the following: consistently conservative Lutheran bodies, the Latter-day Saints, Baptist bodies generally, the Churches of Christ, the Mennonites, and the Adventist bodies. Then he concludes, he says, admittedly, such statistical study cannot say anything precise about the relative impacts which the various denominations have made upon the nation's religious life. Nevertheless, the study has value in the degree to which it throws light on some trends which have marked the American religious community, especially the Christian segment of that community in the first half of the 20th century. Now I'd like to ask you to join me that we take a look at the religious scene today as it is related to the churching of America. I think we must look at the religious scene and get the connection. Let us look at a few of the aspects or characteristics of the religious life of our country. First of all, the present day religious revival. We are in the midst of a strong religious revival. Sidney Ahlstrom, associate professor of church history at Yale, says that the present religious revival is distinguished from earlier ones by the activity of the significant number of, now note this, of first-rate intellectuals, contributing to a renewed theology and a fresh philosophy of religion. Now, what has caused this religious awakening is hard to pin down. Some find the cause in a popular reaction to materialism, but materialism seems to be as widespread as ever. Some find the cause in our fear of communism, but we continue to live with it. Perhaps a truer cause can be found in the American mood. It just seems to be popular and the thing to do to be religious. The boom in church membership is not likely to disturb the present alignment of the three large faiths in America. Roman Catholicism has always been concentrated in our major cities in the following descending order: Chicago, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Newark, Detroit, and Los Angeles. Each of these cities holds more than 1 million Roman Catholics. But there are many other cities besides the large metropolitan areas, and these are frequently centers of Protestant strength. Half of the Jewish people of the world live in the United States, 5 million in all, and half of them are in New York City. Also, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Boston are strong Jewish centers. Rural America is still overwhelmingly Protestant, although the Roman Catholic Church is making a strong bid for this area. But some time ago, I was traveling out of Bismarck, North Dakota, about 10, 15 miles out here, a little chapel, and we wondered what it was. We saw the sign, Rural Catholic Mission. And I'm told this is what they're doing in many rural areas. They're putting out these little Catholic chapels in order to win historically, Protestant rural America. The fact that religious bodies in America number 268 is nothing to get excited about, for 95% of American Protestants are members of 8 major Protestant denominations. A second development in the religious scene in America today is that 2 new religions have appeared on the scene. Dr. Martin Marty, in his book, The New Shape of American Religion, describes one of these and calls it religion in general. It is a sort of deism. It is strongly reminiscent of Christianity, but certainly not Christian. Dr. Marty gives us a description of this new religion in general by quoting the creed of a community church. Compare this with the Apostles' Creed. It reads, I believe in God, the Father all-loving, maker of all that is, and in Jesus Christ, loveliest of his many sons, our friend, who was born of the Mother Mary, moved by the Spirit of God, suffered under the systems of men, was crucified and died for the sake of truth and right. Yet he lives again in the lives made beautiful by his truth, descending to the hearts of men and working at the right hand of God, the Father, who works all that is good. I believe in the Holy Spirit of truth, beauty, and goodness, the ministering Christian church, the communion and cooperation of good men with God and with each other, the destruction of sin by righteousness, the worth and beauty of human personalities, and the everlastingness of the life that is in God. And then they added, Amen. Now, the competitor for attention in America today is not chiefly Roman Catholicism nor Judaism, nor even secularism. Rather, says Dr. Marty, it is in an attitude toward religion in general. He says that's our chief competitor. A religion in general atmosphere prevails throughout our country. Religious music, religious novels, religious pictures are popular. The meetings of Congress, of state legislatures, of many secular commercial organizations open with prayer. Our currency now bears the phrase, In God We Trust. The oath of allegiance now has in it the phrase, Under God. If you feel sort of low at midnight, you can dial a telephone number and receive a devotion. Can, to be sure. You go to the diner on the train, there you find a prayer card confronting you. It is so beautiful, people say, America is so religious. And someone said the atheist has a rough time in the fall during the football season. When Notre Dame plays Southern Methodist, he just sort of shrugs his shoulder and says, I don't care who wins. Now, Dr. Marty continues, if evangelical Christianity is to make its witness heard in the new shape of American religion, it must first of all extricate itself from this generalized national religion. It must clearly show forth a difference between itself and its competitor. Then it can begin to make its way. It is ironic that a national religion should have developed in a nation which had not intended to have one. The second new religion, which has made its appearance in our country, one might almost call it a cult, and this is one area where I hope I'm not quoted because it surely could be misunderstood, and I'm calling this new religion anti-communism. A certain religious halo has been cast around all opposition to communism. With many people, it has virtually become a religion to oppose communism. Now, certainly there is nothing more vicious than atheistic, godless communism, and we want to oppose it and fight it with all the strength at our command. But we want to make sure that we are fighting communism for the right reason, namely because of its atheism, its godlessness, its ruthlessness, and not because it advocates a different political and economic system, although even that in communism is anti-God. I frequently have the suspicion that the great outcry against communism stems from a desire to preserve capitalism with all of its evils. The Christian Church, and this has been an emphasis of our Lutheran Church, does not espouse any particular political or economic system. The Church has thrived under all kinds of systems. This anti-communism religion is part of the present-day religious scene in America, and we must continue to say that opposition to communism does not make you a Christian. And incidentally, it seems strange that many of the people who are violently anti-communists are also segregationists, racially. It'd be interesting for somebody to see what the connection is. Third aspect of a religious scene in America is the third force. This is a term which has recently come into rather common usage in speaking of the church situation in America. The first two forces are, of course, Protestantism, Roman Catholicism. It is not quite accurate to simply refer to this term as applying to all sects and cults. Perhaps the closest definition is that which defines the third force as being primarily those spirit-centered churches, that is, the Pentecostals and holiness bodies. It is significant that these churches frequently experience the greatest growth. 3 years ago, a study was made of the state of California, and the greatest growth was experienced not by Lutherans, Presbyterians, and so forth, but by these third force churches. They have an appeal which sometimes is hard to understand, and certainly they are unconventional in some of their views, especially concerning the institutionalized church. A fourth aspect of the religious scene in America today is the great interest in the laity. Paul Harrison, assistant professor of religion and society in the Department of Religion at Princeton, has this to say about this aspect of the religious scene, this great interest in the laity today. He says, increasing attention is being paid on the fringes of the major Protestant denominations to the role of laymen in the work of the churches. A theology of the laity is in the process of development and represents an effort to distinguish between ecclesiastical and secular vocations of the church's ministry. Despite emphasis, however, on the doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, there is a subtle clericalism in the denominations which undermines the role of laymen. This points to a major dilemma in contemporary Protestantism. Seldom is the ministry aware, and I think this is a very significant statement, seldom is the ministry aware of the developing conception of clergymen as assistants to laymen who act as ministers in the world. On the frontier of Protestant action, there are exciting experiments to seek solution for this dilemma, but the work is usually frustrated by a tendency to institutionalize the experiment and by the apathy of the laymen themselves, unquote. Well, there are several other aspects we could speak about, but I'm going to hurry on because my time is running out. The great emphasis on new church buildings today. Last year we spent almost $1 billion on new church construction. We could talk about another aspect that we're developing a class church, very definitely. And I think this is due to the fact that our churches don't serve communities, they serve classes of people. We talk about indigenous church work in foreign countries. We don't even have it here at home. The average congregation does not serve its community. It serves a class of people from all over. And so we cannot expect our foreign churches to be indigenous. We don't even have that here. Now, what about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the Churching of America? What has been our contribution? Well, very quickly, let's just these two statistics, 1% and 2%. Our membership today represents about 1% of the population, and our membership today, roughly speaking, about 2% of the church population. We open about 100 new mission congregations a year, on the average. Our strength is concentrated in 12 north central states. The average size of our congregations is increasing. However, the Missouri Synod pastor serves less souls than the pastor in any other Lutheran body. The Missouri Synod pastor serves 543 on the average souls. All the other Lutheran bodies, in all the other Lutheran bodies, the pastors serve more than they do in the Missouri Synod. Another characteristic of our Churching of America is that I think our Missouri Synod is experiencing a change in attitude over against home missions. A growing realization in our Synod that we are not alone in the Churching of America. We are beginning to take more and more cognizance of the fact that there are other Christians at work in this land. And for this we are grateful. We ought to thank God daily for those pastors and other denominations who preach the way of salvation as you and I know it and preach it. We're grateful for the help of others. For that reason, and also because of the many unmet opportunities, our board has encouraged district boards to consult with the representatives, particularly of other Lutheran bodies. And in most districts now, there is such consultation. And our district mission boards confer with the regional committees of the National Lutheran Council, primarily to avoid duplication so that we don't wake up one morning and we've both established new churches right on the same intersection. And these consultations, this is not comity, this is merely consultation. These consultations are proving very worthwhile. I cannot help, and this is the freedom we had at the conference, I cannot help but call attention to three home mission practices prevalent today which I think are bad. Practices in our own sin. The first is, to my way of thinking, we are establishing too many of our new churches merely for the convenience of Lutherans. Now I realize that when we find a concentration of Lutherans in a community where they cannot be served by another Lutheran church, the District Mission Board should consider the question, what about ministering to these people? However, this is not my concern. I am ready to admit that the church has a responsibility of serving its people to the extent that this is possible and in keeping with the Great Commission. My concern is this. All too often today yet, when a proposed new field is described, one of the first observations is, we find a concentration of Lutherans there. And then we frequently rush out to establish a new church there for the convenience of these Lutherans, and sometimes with an utter disregard for other Christian churches that may be nearby or even present in the community. Now, I said this, I was taken to task for the conference, I'm saying it anyway. I know of instances where Lutheran people who once held membership in a church in the city moved out to some suburb and immediately began clamoring for the establishment of a new Lutheran church in that particular suburb because it would be more convenient. And yet, every day, these same people on their way to work drove right by the church to which they had formerly belonged. Can't you just imagine the reaction of a pretty hard-boiled general manager or a famous bar or sticks if someone came to him and said, won't you please establish another store out there where I live so I will not have to drive so far? And yet, that is what these people expect the church to do. I'm not even sure that it is a good thing to have a large nucleus of Lutherans in a new mission. I've had some of our district mission secretaries tell me that sometimes this is a handicap. Frequently, transferred Lutherans come and want to reintroduce at the new church some of the bad customs and habits which they had at the church to which they formerly belonged. I'm submitting today that the primary purpose in extending our mission is not to establish churches merely for the convenience of Lutherans. The chief and first question must still be, when considering a new community, is this a field where we could, with the establishment of a new church, reach a large number of people who are now not followers of the Lord Jesus and would otherwise not be reached with the gospel. That must still be the primary question. At the Fifth Mission Conference 1958, the whole mission leaders in the districts virtually said the same thing. They said we shouldn't start a new mission until you could be sure that for the first service, half of the people who promised to attend would be unchurched prospects. I mean, we've said it before, but my impression is that to a large extent, or too often at least, we establish our new churches merely for the convenience of Lutherans, and to that I object. Another practice which characterizes our Lutheran churching of America, or one might almost say unchurching of America, is that we leave communities where the density of population is the greatest and establish ourselves where the density of population is the lowest. As a rule, population density is the greatest in the city, particularly the inner city. Yet in recent years, a number of congregations have literally moved out from this concentration and established themselves where, by comparison, they could reach a smaller number of people. But how, in the name of common sense, can we as Christians justify this kind of a practice? That we simply pull out. Incidentally, something related to this is, and that is the ecumenicity which sometimes is practiced in this process. I refer to the practice of selling our church property and turning over a field to the denomination with which we are not in fellowship. At least I have not read that fellowship has been established between our synod and the Pentecostals and Nazarenes and Baptists. How then can we turn over our property and fields and people to one of these churches? Why don't we get excited about this? We're getting excited about many lesser things in our synod. I don't know why somebody isn't getting excited about this. The third practice, all too prevalent, is that we are passing by entirely and large Negro communities in our churching program. We seem to have become so concerned about integration that we're doing virtually little or nothing in the way of establishing new churches in concentrated Negro communities, where integration is not possible because there's nobody to integrate. They're all black. Our synod, our board, various districts have long been on record that our churches must serve all people, regardless of race or color, and we have a long way to go. My concern is, have we been so intent upon integration that we've gone to the other extreme, that we do not even think of reaching the Negro with the gospel unless it can be done on an integrated basis? There are large Negro communities with no white people in them, and in the past 4 or 5 years, we've established only 2 or 3 such churches. So according to my way of thinking, these are home mission practices prevalent in our synod, to which I object, and I think it is high time that we rethink and revise them. I'm going to close with just a few words on our opportunities. Do we still have opportunities for expanding the church in America? Sometimes we hear it said, America is Christian. So Christian, we're very limited in the opportunities. Let me just put it this way. Today, there are still 70 million people not connected with any religious group, and then keep in mind that that was the population of this country only 70 years ago. 70 years ago, the population was 70 million, and today that is the number of people in our country who are not affiliated with any religious group. Other home mission experts and other denominations with whom I've met, they say that just to take care of the population growth, Protestant churches ought to establish about 4,000 new congregations a year. That would make no dent on the present unchurched. That would merely take care of the population growth. Sounds almost fantastic, but they have it figured out. 2 years ago, Dr. Hoyer, the director of Home Missions and National Lutheran Council at that time, said that the Lutheran churches of America ought to establish 400 new congregations every year. Then he said to us, he says, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, you're about one-third of Lutheranism. You ought to establish about 135 a year, and it so happens that is our objective, but we're not reaching it. We're only establishing about 100 a year. Finally, our greatest need, I am fully aware of the fact that if we are to play our role in the churching of America, we need men and money. However, I am not ready to state that these are our greatest needs. I believe that our greatest need is to take time out and once again think about the real objective of the church and the real objective of our church in America, that we develop a sense of mission. The And we do this, and when we become clear as to the direction in which we are to go, I believe that the needs for manpower and money can also be met. And this was the purpose of our conference in the early part of January, to rethink our objective. In his book, The Resurgence of the Gospel, Cantillon says, as carriers of the word, the early Christians were primarily witnesses, living epistles of Christ, rather than dealers in documents. The secret of their influence lay in the fact that their allegiance was to a person and not to a protocol or system, unquote. So in home missions, we must constantly reevaluate our protocol, our system, so that everything we do to Church America may be centered in a person and not in a system, even though hallowed by long years of usage.
We have about 10 minutes for discussion in case someone would like to say something or ask a question for further elucidation by Dr. Hillman. Yes, sir?
Yes, we felt that if this conference was to really be worthwhile, that these concerns would have to reach our pastors and our people. And so we have suggested some steps for implementation to this conference. The one step is that each district mission board, incidentally, all the papers have been published and duplicated in the complete report, each district mission board was asked to hold a similar conference on the district level. And then that this material be brought down into the pastoral conferences. And the May issue of Advance will carry a special clergy insert of 12 pages giving a digest of this conference so that this fall pastoral conferences can also consider these concerns which we discussed at this conference.
Just a moment. Take the boy. Take the young man in front here first. I'll get to the next one.
Yes. Now, in the past, about half of the calls which came from mission boards were for opening new stations. Our preliminary survey shows that this spring there will be about 100 calls from mission boards. Now, these are not all for new stations. Many of these are for stations already established. But district mission boards, or through district mission boards, there will be coming about 100 calls. Between 40 and 50 of these will be for new stations. So those of you who are graduating, and some of you might look forward to this, that you might get a call to help open a new station. You may immediately ask, is this good, that this very important work of establishing a new station is entrusted to a man who just comes out of the seminary? I asked that question, too, when in 1930 I was assigned to a new station in Seattle, Washington, with no experience whatever. I had nothing to start with. And we've discussed this frequently in mission conferences, but there is a great difference of opinion. Some of our district mission boards feel that our graduates today do an outstanding job under proper orientation at a new mission, do a very satisfactory job. One of our district mission boards says we prefer to get a candidate for a new station. If we get an experienced man, he sometimes has to unlearn certain practices before he can really do an effective job at a new station. And so it divides up about half and half. Half of our districts prefer a graduate for a new station. Others prefer to call an experienced man. But for this spring, there will be about 40 to 50 calls for new stations.
All right.
Is certainly one of the problems. I believe at the present time in our entire educational system there are 5 Negro students. And so our Negro Christians also have to be encouraged to send their boys if we're going to do an outreach job among the American Negro. And you ask what is being done to encourage this. Part of the recruitment program which is presently underway is also going to be directed at our Negro congregations to enlist young Negro pastors, young Negroes to study for the ministry. Now, there are many other subsequent problems. Sometimes the Negro boy who studies at a northern school doesn't want to go back to the South, and so forth. I mean, those are also all other problems. But the thing is, we do need more Negro students to prepare for the ministry.
Might I ask a question in that connection? Do you think that the work among the Negroes, and then also this other phase in which I'm very much interested, this work in the inner city, is receiving increasing emphasis in the work of our district mission boards?
Yes, I think it is, because more and more the districts are being made aware of the fact that this is their responsibility. There is one district in which the Synodical Conference still operates the Negro work, and that is the Southern District. However, at the present time, steps are underway that within the next year or two, the Southern District will also take over this work, this Negro work in the Southern area. When that is accomplished, then all of the districts of our Synod will have the full, total responsibility for Negro work. And then I think we can really get going and emphasize that this is their responsibility. Inner city is, made a reference to inner city. This is, of course, a very difficult problem. I tell you, the approach which I like, this matter of inner city, I think you need men who have a feel for this kind of work, who understand these people. The Presbyterian Church has been experimenting with something for the past several years. They provide scholarship funds for 2 graduates each year to go out for a 1-year internship. These are graduates. To go out for a 1-year internship to work with another pastor who is working at an inner city church. And after this 1-year internship, there's a consultation to see if they would like to go into this work, if they have a feel for it, a know-how for it. If so, then this man is given a call to an inner-city church. You see, most of us don't come from that background. We'd have to shift gears, wouldn't we? Let's be honest, to really work at an inner-city church. Now, that's not fault. We don't want to fault men for not being able to do it. We don't come from that background. But I think we must train men to go into this kind of work, and that's why the Presbyterian plan somewhat appeals to. Maybe we'll talk to you about that.
Yes, sir. Brad.
Well, that has been very slow, just beginning to do a little of that. The Michigan District in Detroit, for example, has in the last few years begun to help a few of these, but it's rather late. I think you know the Detroit story. Our past years, a number of congregations moved out. But more and more districts are doing this. And in order to encourage them, our board asked the Episcopal Conference last year for $50,000 that any district wanting to take over a church which has been vacated by a congregation, so that church might stay in the inner city, that we might help them with subsidy. The Episcopal Conference liked the idea. They said we didn't ask for enough. They gave us $100,000 for next year. And now we have several districts coming to us asking for subsidy in order that they might really begin doing some intensive work in the inner city. Texas District, for example, got help for Dallas, where they took over a congregation. The congregation had vacated, took over the property. They're going to stay there now in this integrated community in the inner city and do a job. And we're helping them with subsidy.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's an educational process, and very little, I'm afraid, is being done on. We've encouraged this. I think maybe one of the things, the question I answered before about implementing this home mission conference, that's one of the concerns is going to be discussed very much in the pastoral conference this fall and this winter. Maybe through that we'll begin to make an impact that congregations, before this thing happens, are educated to the fact that they are there to serve a community regardless. Very little being done so far.
Our time has about elapsed. I want to take this opportunity then to thank Pastor Hilmer for coming out here, for addressing us, and giving us this viewpoint of his. I might say I'm particularly happy that we have it at this time, because we realize that it won't be too long before the annual assignment of calls is made, and of course those who are in the graduating class, also those who are coming up for vicarages, are very much interested in what might be the case there, as one of the questions revealed too. Now I think to get something like this on the what and the why is very important for us, and there I'm thinking not only of the students, also of us as professors. We used to think, that is when we were students, and I suppose later generations of students did too, that, well, if you didn't get a call into a foreign mission field when you graduated from the seminary, then you were safe, you would never be asked to serve in a foreign field. I'm happy to say that that is changing, and I think it must continue to change. I feel that this applies also to these other phases of the work that in some respects appear more difficult, or perhaps we should say less popular in the mind of many members of the church. So I think that we should take this opportunity to make sure that we do some introspection too, and all of us recognize that the Lord may call us here or may call us there at any time, and that we should be ready, if it's His will, to go. Thank you.